Hello and welcome to another Emmy edition of the Water Cooler Podcast. I'm your host, Clarence Moy, and I'm joined by the co-star of FX's acclaimed limited series, Mrs. America. Sarah, welcome to the Water Cooler.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited. You know, I was looking at your resume and I didn't realize that for like almost the past 8 to 10 years, you have worked exclusively in the Ryan Murphy realm, which is pretty astounding. You know, I've watched American Horror Story, watched Crime Story, Feud, all of those things, but I didn't realize that that was sort of where you had kept your influence within the television world.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true from a television perspective, totally. Yeah. And probably because I think he just does some of the best stuff and continues to, you know, he continues to ask me to do it, which is a really good reason why I continue to say yes, because he's asking. But with this one, with Mrs. America, I did actually, when this came my way, I went to Ryan and I just said, if I say yes to this, it means I can't do American Horror Story. And are you okay with that? And he said, yes. You've been with us for so long, and the great thing about horror stories is that people go and they come back, and so you'll go and then you'll come back. And I said, okay, great. And so I was able to do this, which was great.
So I actually meant to start with a question, just making sure that you're doing well and given the pandemic and all of the things that are ongoing right now. I mean, it actually feels like we're living in an episode of American Horror Story.
Yeah, it surely does. I am doing well. Thank you for asking. Everyone I know and love is safe and healthy, knock on wood. I only know one person in New York who got very, very sick, but did make it out, and that's good. It was a little scary for a moment there. And it does feel totally surreal and otherworldly. And it is, now we are far enough into it where it's almost hard to imagine things being as they were, in a funny way, for me.
True.
I can't imagine waking up at 5 a.m. and driving to work and spending a whole day on set with all of those people without masks and on a soundstage, and just the casualness with which I used to pump gas feels totally, you know, think about it. You put your hand on that pump and then you wipe your hand and you touch your eye and you pick up your phone. And I mean, I would no more do that now for all the money in the world. I mean, it's like, will I ever be a person who doesn't pump gas wearing a glove again? Who knows? You know, it's really wild.
As soon as this hit, I found myself just randomly touching my face, and they just, you know, of course they were saying not to touch your face, and I'm walking around weirdly, like clasping my hands like I'm some funeral director or something.
Well,
like
it's because you don't realize, you know, we all have kind of physical lives and behaviors that we're not even conscious of. Right. And touching one's face, like I just did it just now. I just touched my nose without even thinking about it. And, you know, because I'm in my house and I haven't left and I wash my hands, I think I'm okay. But I wonder what it will be like to go back to quote unquote normal. And I don't know if there will ever be normal again.
The new normal. I couldn't even hazard a guess.
I know.
So you were mentioning, you know, obviously you've been a muse to Ryan Murphy and you've worked on a lot of these projects. We talked about that a few minutes ago, but, and walking onto the set with Davi Waller for Mrs. America, what was that experience like to be working for and with another showrunner, that perhaps doesn't have the same rhythms and isn't Ryan Murphy? So.
Yeah, it's really funny because the blessing of always working with Ryan is that I know what to expect. The problem, if I could pick one problem, because there aren't any problems, but if there were one problem, it would probably be that I walk on any set that isn't a Ryan set and they don't all function in the same way. And I'm always a little bit surprised because I've become so used to working in a particular way. And this was different. I had sat down, Kate Blanchett and I share an agent, and I've worked with her 3 times now, so I guess I can just say, call her Kate, but you know, I actually call her other nicknames too, but I'm not going to share those now because it's just too embarrassing. because we've worked together 3 times, as I said, so my agent called me and said, you know, Kate's going to do this thing. It hasn't been announced yet. Do you want to sit down with Davi and Stacy and Coco, the other producers, and see if this is something you might want to do? And I did. And Davi is so smart. And what she was talking about was the scope of this piece was so vast and hard to imagine how they were going to do it all. And I was just so fascinated by her commitment to it and just the utter, you know, shock that she was going to bite this off. And And I just, they weren't even sure what part they were offering me at the moment. They mentioned a few that I could play, all on the conservative side. And I thought, you know, I only had the first two scripts to read, and they thought that Alice would be the most interesting thing for me to do. And they knew what they were planning on doing with her in the latter half of the series, whereas the other people, they weren't as sure. And she just said, you know, do you want to take this jump? And I don't even know exactly what it's going to be. And I said, look, that's one thing I've been doing for a long time with Ryan, is you never know exactly what it's going to be, particularly on American Horror Story. It's like, you just say yes. You don't even know what character you're going to play, what it's going to look like, what it will mean, but you want to be part of the world. So you say yes. And this was an opportunity for me to do something outside of Horror Story on television, in the television space. And I haven't done that in so long that I thought, if I'm going to do it, doing it with Kate and doing it with Dobby and doing it with a subject matter like this and a network that I have spent a lot of time working at, was, it felt like it was a pretty safe bet to roll the dice with this one.
Yeah.
In terms of its quality being something that I could be excited to be part of.
Sure. So as I was looking at, you know, resume, I'm reminded, of course, that you were in American Horror Story Cult, where you played Allie. So that's one end of the political spectrum, the outrage as spurred on by the Trump administration and the Trump election of 2016. And then, of course, you've got Alice, who back in the 70s was a meeker, quieter, conservative voice who goes on a journey. So which one do you think that it's more challenging to play for you personally, someone who is meek and expressing that voice, or someone like Allie who is learning to express it through rage?
Well, let's just say this. I tend to have rage at my fingertips more readily as a person. I think my anger is something that I have never really shied away from in my work. And you can ask people I'm very close to. It's my access to it is quite something. So I actually think, but strangely enough, sometimes I think playing things that are actually close to you are sometimes hard, because you don't always have a full awareness of what that's like in yourself. So you don't even know how to access it. But playing Alice, you know, I kind of tried to think about my grandmother, who is a conservative woman still, and married my grandfather very soon after college and started a family and never worked outside the home. And my grandmother is a wonderful woman, incredibly kind and open and generous and soft and all these things that I thought were really, really Alice's fundamental qualities, and probably really why she's able to have happen to her what happens to her in episode 8, where she goes to the convention and has this utterly other eye-opening experience that I think if Alice were even just the tiniest bit more closed-minded or shut down emotionally and not so open and innocent in a way, she wouldn't have been able to have that experience. Certainly the other women in the Eagle Forum would not have had that experience. I don't think they would have taken the pill, and I don't think they would have been so despondent at failing, speaking about the movement, about the counter movement, publicly, the way Alice, when she falters, is so humiliated because, you know, she's so worried about disappointing Phyllis and having that confronting moment of being said, you know, being spoken to by a reporter who basically challenges the factual nature of what she's saying. And then Alice is open enough to question, what have I been told? What is wrong about what I know? And some of the other characters, I think their closed-mindedness prevents some of the possibility for the you know, that being permeated. And so I sort of tried to approach it that way. And it wasn't easy because, you know, I have particular political views that are much more aligned with the feminist movement. And so that was interesting, but it was a really wonderful opportunity to learn about other points of view. And, you know, we get so mired in the only ways that we have been taught to think that it's very hard to imagine why or how other people get to particular viewpoints, you know, because it's so foreign to us. We don't share that worldview, so we can't imagine how they arrive at it. But, you know, a lot of really good, there are good people in this world, open-hearted, generous, good people who don't, you know, have the same political views I do. And it was a really wonderful opportunity to put myself in the shoes of someone I don't align myself with politically. And that's sort of the job as an actor, is to put that on and hopefully put it back out there for audiences to see and be reminded themselves, like, oh, right, that's just a It's just a woman who has a different set of views, and but is still fundamentally good. And we have to remember that having an alternative view doesn't automatically make someone hateful, or awful, or uneducated, or ignorant. It just makes it other. And it's really important to try to have a little bit of openness around that. Otherwise, I don't know how any change can really happen.
When audiences watch that episode number 8, which is called Houston, is that the primary thing that you would like for them to take away from that episode, that there are alternate opinions out there, and not everyone has to be sort of raging against each other? There doesn't have to be that hatred. There's sort of that openness and understanding between different political perspectives.
I think what I would like to be taken away from that episode more than anything is this reminder that people who don't think the way you think are still human beings. They still have hopes, dreams, wants. They laugh, they love, they cry. There's like this separation that we do when there isn't alignment of thought. You know, we tend to surround ourselves with those that think like we do, and that's because, you know, it's comfortable. But I think it's very easy to turn people who don't have the same views as you into an enemy. And in order to make them an enemy that you can stand behind, you have to forget that they're people. And I think that's something Alice sees when the curtain is pulled back, that the women on the other side of the movement are not actually trying to take anything from her. Mm-hmm. They just want something for themselves. And Alice has a different want for herself. But the idea that their want doesn't supersede hers and doesn't make her want invalidated. It's just a different want. But Alice has learned to believe that wanting what they want is to take something away from her, because she's listening to a person who is only telling her things that support that line of thinking, which are actually not fact-based. And because Alice isn't educated enough to go beyond or to vet what she's being told by this woman that she reveres in Phyllis Schlafly, and that she's so proud and excited, turns to her for guidance and friendship, you know, that Phyllis wants to be best friends with Alice makes Alice feel very valuable, very important, and very seen, and as if she matters. And she's so frightened that the women's liberation movement wants to take that from her and take away her value in her own home, which is actually not what they're wanting to do. So I think it would be wonderful if people could take away the idea that we're all people and we're all human beings doing our level best, and some more so than others, and some with introspection and interest in that arena of understanding self, and others with less of that at the forefront of their interest. But beating hearts, minds, wants, loves, needs, you know, it's very easy to keep things divisive by forgetting that. And when we forget that, we're much more likely to be calcified in our own way of thinking. And I think it's important to not do that. And I think this episode shows that there's real value to letting that go.
I'm so amazed. I was looking at the list of limited series contenders this year. I'm so amazed by how many are either otherworldly set or period set, but they're so applicable to our current environment. Whereas, you know, take that message away from Mrs. America in episode 8, and you've got Watchmen with, you know, all of the things going on there. You've got Hollywood. You know, it's just amazing that all of these series are sort of speaking to a moment that is right now. And I think it's really important that these series are out there and discussed because of the fact that, you know, audiences can draw from that.
Absolutely. I mean, what's both wonderful and terrifying, though, is that like a lot of these shows take place at a different time. And here we are all these years later, and they are so relevant today, which means progress has been made, but maybe not nearly as much as we thought. And as much as we would like to think, so much movement has been made on race issues, gender issues, voting rights. There's just so much work to do, and it's overwhelming, but it's certainly wonderful to know that there are, that for some people, they can learn a great deal from doing the one thing that our parents wanted us to do so little of as children, which is watch TV. Right. Watch that TV. There's so much content now where you can actually learn something. It's gone are the days where it's just sort of only vapid entertainment, although I'm sure many people creating shows in the 70s and 80s would disagree that it was vapid. And it's I'm not trying to wipe all that away. I'm just saying there's so much important storytelling happening now. And now it's like you do very well to have your children watch a lot of the stuff that's being made now. And it would be a really good idea, in fact.
Right. It's like Norman Lear in the 70s with the platforms that he was pushing forward. It's like we have many more of those now and much bolder, broader, more diverse, inclusive voices than we did in the 70s.
Yeah, exactly.
So Alice Goes Down the Rabbit Hole in Houston. That's obviously her name is Alice for a thematic benefit. One of my favorite moments of that episode is when Alice sings This Land Is Your Land, Woody Guthrie's, with that, you know, it's just almost nearly sings the entire song there. What was that moment like for you? Describe that moment filming for you.
Well, I can describe it for you very directly and acutely, which is one of abject terror, because I'm not a singer, and I kept like putting off like practicing it because I was like, you know, Alice doesn't have to sing well, and you know, she's a mother of young children and she's been singing to them for years and she sings in church and she's not cutting an album or anything. And yet there's something that happens when you're filming something that always this thing kicks in where you don't want to suck and you don't want to fail and you don't, you know, want to embarrass yourself totally. And I remember we were rehearsing and there was Niecy Nash, who plays Flo Kennedy, and we rehearsed it and she turned to me, she's like, well, I know you're not doing it like that. And I was like, what? And she was like, you're going to have to put a Sarah Paulson thing on it. And I was like, what are you actually talking about? And she was like, well, you sound so timid. I know you're not going to, you're Sarah Paulson. And I was like, I don't know what she's talking about. I was like, what am I going to do? So it was actually Niecy that inspired me to kind of push myself out of my, you know, because I'm sure whether I meant to or not, we were rehearsing and I was being quite shy about it. And I wasn't sure what was going to come out of me when they say action, because sometimes there's a great disparity between my rehearsal performance and my shooting performance, because, and not from some great, you know, methodology of trying to save it for the camera, but just, I'm still kind of figuring it out sometimes. And there's an extra little thing that happens when the camera's there, or when you're out in front of an audience on stage, that just revs something up into another lane and, or to another speed rather. And, so I didn't know what I was going to do, but it was Niecy. It was just like the thought of embarrassing myself in front of the genius that is Niecy Nash. I just thought, I will not go down like that. So I'm going to do this. And so that moment will always be forever tied to Niecy, sort of pushing me to be bold, even though it seemed like she thought boldness was part of what I was going to do. And I just didn't have the heart to break it to her to say that if she had not said that, I probably would have done something really meek, because, you know, it would have been in line with what Alice's sensibility was prior to this moment. It probably wouldn't have been as good as really trying to belt it out, which I tried to do. And I did see it, and it just makes me want to cry. I can't believe the way I sound.
No, but it was great. No, it was great. So I did talk to Niecy this year, and she told me a little secret about you, that she thinks that you are one of the funniest women that she's ever met. And there may be talks of a side project between the two of you at some point, maybe, potentially.
Yes, there is. Niecy, the thing about me and Niecy is that, and I don't know if Niecy remembers this, but Niecy, when she was first nominated for an Emmy, I was also nominated that year. And they always do this wonderful event that I love so much, which is like the class photo of the the year of all the nominees, and you get a certificate and you're standing there with all of your peers and you look around and you can't believe all these incredible actors. And the fact that you're standing there, it just feels like an absolute dream, and it is the truth. And it feels that way now, and it will always feel that way if I were to ever find myself in that position again. I know it would never become an old story to me. But I was standing next to Niecy, and I just was like, I'm so happy for you. I mean, Getting On was just a show that I could not get enough of. And I thought she was so brilliant on, and I was so happy for her. And she just like, I just went up to her and I said, you know, I think you're the greatest actress. You're the greatest actress. And she was just like, please stop. I'm going to cry. I can't, this is the most overwhelming thing. I can't even believe this is happening. She was so in the spirit of feeling that feeling of being so moved and excited that, you know, we all spend a lot of time pretending like these things are not as cool as they are, because I guess it's uncool to be excited about being celebrated in that way. We have a funny relationship with feeling good about those moments when your work is highlighted. You of course always feel humbled by it, but there is also excitement and there is also a real thrill, a childlike thrill that you can't believe that someone else thought you were worthy. And it touches on so many things that we all struggle with as people in terms of being valuable and being worthy. And so it was very, she was so in the moment of that and it was so moving to me. And then I just went on and on and she was like, I really need you to shut up now. And so we would see each other at events off and on, and I just always so revered her. So then when we had this little tiny moment to do in Mrs. America, we were sort of backstage as it was where we were shooting. There was this little like green room we were in and we were just laughing and talking. We just talked about how it would be really great if we could do something outside of what would maybe be expected. And she just always, she does think I'm really funny, which I feel so flattered by because there's no one funnier than Niecy. But I also think there's not a better actor, dramatic actress than Niecy. She's extraordinary. There's nothing she can't do. I think she's incredible. But so the fact that she thinks I'm funny, I'm just like, someone come up with a buddy picture for us to do. I mean, like, why not? We were bandying little ideas around and we gotta do it. I think we gotta do it.
You do have to do it because I think you need to do more comedy. Because I do think
I don't get to do a lot of it. I don't.
No, you don't.
You know, it's like anything else. You get so and it's really, I think, a lack of imagination by you know, whatever the entity that is Hollywood as a whole. You know, people like to do what they can guarantee will work. And if they know you do dramatic stuff or they know you can cry and run and scream because you've been doing that for a decade on a TV show and you get offered a bunch of horror movies because they know you can do that and they're willing to roll the dice on that front. But, you know, I just wish they'd get a little more creative and imagine that, like, if I can do that, maybe I can do this. I'm happy to audition. I'm happy to try to prove it to you. But people get such a narrow view about what's possible with actors. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, like, part of the job is to be able to do all of that stuff. And
right.
I wish it weren't such a surprise when a really brilliant comedian does something dramatic and people are like, I had no idea. It's like, why? Don't they talk about, you know, comedy is tragedy plus time? You know what I mean? Like it's, I don't know. So that's a whole other conversation, but.
Well, Sarah, I think that's all the time that we have. So thank you so much. I can't wait to see you in Ratched, of course, coming up.
Well, maybe we'll get to talk about that then.
Absolutely.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you so care. Much.
Best too. Of luck to you. And
stay healthy. Yeah, you yes. too.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.